Will, I've got good news for you.
Okay.
Contrary to what I thought a couple of weeks ago, I have not, in fact, actually threatened to kill anyone on the internet to date, as far as I know.
Wait, are you talking about your kill file?
Maybe.
I look, sometimes we talk about things and I'm like, I would like to know more about this. And sometimes we talk about them and I'm like, I'm just going to move on and pretend that we never talked about that.
Oh, man. So
you're talking about your IRC kill file or your Usenet kill file?
So, yeah, was it the last Patreon episode we did?
That seems right.
A couple weeks ago. Time has no meaning. Yeah, the last Patreon episode we did, we very painfully dug into our post history on Usenet and the Ars forums and some other places from 20, 25 years ago.
Which, yep.
If you're thinking about doing that yourself, don't.
I found a new source of that information later.
Oh, no. What was it?
I can't say without it becoming apparent where it comes from.
So that's sensitive, huh?
We're not going to talk about it, though.
Hot post material.
5,000 patrons. That's the episode.
Wow. Okay. Well, that means it's at least fit for public consumption.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't anything awful. It was just embarrassing. Really, really embarrassing.
Not ruin your career bad.
No.
Okay. Anyway, we were going through old Usenet posts for that Patreon episode, and I had one that I was going to read.
And you chickened out.
Well, I think you also advised me not to read it because I thought it was me threatening to kill someone.
Go ahead and read the post, Brad.
Okay, here we go. Let's see. In alt.games.finalfantasy on September 19th, 1997.
And you know, in the alt news groups, anything goes, Brad.
Let's see. In response to somebody who spoiled Wild Arms, the JRPG for the PlayStation in some fashion. I think he talked about somebody dying or something. Anyway, my response to this person. Thank you so very fucking much. I haven't finished Wild Arms yet, and now I don't even know if I'll bother. If I had a kill file, you'd top the list.
90s Brad voice is my favorite.
Oh boy, man.
You sound so self-entitled.
Anyway, well, dude,
are you a spoiler guy?
Video games were expensive. This was 96, man. 97. This was like, God, this wasn't even in Aeris Dias territory yet, was it? It was like months before that, right?
So, okay.
I'm trying to remember the timeline. That's right around the time Final Fantasy VII came out, right? So, like, spoilers were the thing back then, right? Like, Aeris Dias was the proto-spoiler.
I just...
On Usenet.
Is Aeris Dias a Final Fantasy VII thing?
Yes. It was unthinkable that they would kill off a main party member like that, and yet people ran around all over the internet shouting it from the rooftops.
So, I just played Final Fantasy VII for the first time...
Wait.
...with the remake. I never played it before.
Wait, did I...
So spoilers, I guess, Brad.
Did I just spoil Aeris Dias for you?
I had no idea what that meant.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Hey, in 2027, when the next installment of that remake comes out, buckle up. Some shit's going to go down.
Yeah, if they ever release that, it'll be very exciting for me. So
did I really, in 2021, just spoil Aeris Dias for somebody?
I had no idea.
Excuse me, Aerith Dias?
Yeah, Aerith Dias.
Yes. Anyway.
She's my favorite. She really dies.
Oh, dude, I've got bad news for you. I cannot believe this just happened.
Fuck.
I didn't even get to the point where I explained what the kill file actually is.
We should explain what the kill file is so people don't think your teen self was a nascent murderer.
You're probably right. Okay, I paused there because that seemed like a good place to end that cold open. So anyway, like randomly a week or two ago after we did that episode, I somehow stumbled on the fact that a kill file on Usenet was actually like a filter, like a text-based filter that you kept.
Yeah, that's what you told the cops.
Like any names, like terms and subject lines, like any, you know, filtering mechanisms you put in that kill file, it would just weed out those posts.
Yeah. Yeah, it would weed them out, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh. Yes. Cut them down to size.
Yeah, happy Final Fantasy guy 69 is sleeping with the fishes, Brad. That's what I'm saying.
Put out a hit on any post mentioning the term Aerith, for example. Anyway, I just want to clear the air between you and me and now the world that I wasn't, as far as I know, to date, still death threat free on the internet for me.
Well, I know what I'm putting on my kill file now, Brad. Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. I'm still sorry.
Spoiler free since 2021, baby.
That's right. Start the clock over.
It's
been 0 days since we spoiled Final Fantasy VII on this podcast.
Well, so here's the weird thing. Like, I have a weird relationship with spoilers because, like, I saw Return of the Jedi before I saw Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
Just because there was no home video back then, and, like, I read the novelization of Empire Strikes Back probably before I saw the movie.
Oh, gosh. I just realized, as we will get into on this very episode, I guess you were old enough to kind of remember how those movies rolled out, right? As opposed to, like, to me, they're all just, like, I think my parents took me to Return of the Jedi as, like, a four-year-old. But to me, they're all just a mashup of things I saw on home video, right? But yeah. you actually saw them and remember them.
Well, so for me, CBS aired Star Wars, like, on primetime TV 1 year. And we recorded it off of the TV. Like, I still remember where the ad breaks in Star Wars were.
Wow.
Like, when the Jawa raises his arms, or when the sand person raises his arms and goes, ar. That's when the first ad break was.
That's a good cliffhanger.
Yeah. So I saw that. I saw Return of the Jedi in theaters, but I was too young to see Empire when I was six. And I probably wouldn't have remembered anyway. So I had no idea. Like, it comes in and, like, all of a sudden Luke and Leia are siblings. I was like, what the hell's going on here? This is really weird. Anyway, that's my Star Wars cliffhanger thing. I didn't see Empire until I was like 10, probably to like 85.
Yeah.
When it came out on video.
Well, spoiler warning. That's all I can say.
It's just nothing but spoilers here this week.
That's right. Some hot 1975 bangers.
I mean, it is. 1975 was an important year for me, it turns out.
It's a fine vintage for you and also science and technology, it seems.
This episode was a suggestion by your partner?
Yes, friend? yes. My okay. partner, girlfriend.
Yes. And I think it seemed like fun. So here we are. Yeah. We're going to do it. What are we doing this week?
I had a really morose idea for this week that didn't feel great. And then she was like, can we just say it? It's your birthday. Hey, happy birthday, Will.
Hey, thanks, man.
Yeah. And I mentioned to her that we were going to be recording on your birthday. And she was like, why don't you go through all the tech that happened the year he was born?
And it turned out to be a really important year for technology. Who knew?
And then we pulled up a timeline and, like, holy crap, like, what a fine vintage you are.
I was born in 1975.
Yeah.
Which was not the year we make contact, but it was close to it, I guess. I don't know how we should do this.
We got stuff arranged into a loose order here, kind of.
Yeah.
To some degree.
So we kind of, the way we came up with this list of things is we hit, like, the Wikipedia list for stuff that happened in technology and stuff that happened in 1975. And then we dug a little deeper onto some of it. I think there's probably at least one or maybe two more episodes, I think, that will come out of things that we're going to talk about here, if I had to guess.
That's very, for given the amount of time we spent on YouTube watching people work in Altair 8800.
I'm so curious.
I don't know if I'm, like, extremely curious or if I can never watch any of that again. Like, it's a lot.
I kind of want to load up the core because there's a Mr. Core for the 8800.
Yes, of course, because, like, it's such an early computer, there aren't really games for it. So I was like, no, there won't be a Mr. Core, but of course there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe the video output of that Mr. Core is just the front panel of that thing, which is covered in lights and toggle switches.
Do I have to get a serial port for my Mr. in order to use it?
You absolutely can do legitimate serial output from the 8800 core on the Mr. from the GPIO pins.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. So the first thing on our list, and I think this is probably arguably the most important thing that happened
maybe. There's some bangers on here.
Well, like, from a computing perspective, though, I think this was the big one. The Altair 8800 came out in January. I knew nothing about this computer, it turns out.
I didn't really either. I've heard the name for years as an important milestone in computing history, but I didn't really know exactly what it was or why it happened. But right off the bat, the funniest thing about it is I think it was both revealed and launched in January in an issue of Popular Mechanics.
It was Popular Electronics, I thought.
You might be right, actually. Let me pull up that page.
Popular Electronics was a...
Was that, like, affiliated with Popular Mechanics?
I think eventually it all got merged in. Became popular.
You're right. It was Popular Electronics.
But yeah, this is the computer. If you've ever seen pictures of old computers, this is the one that is widely credited with kicking off the microprocessor revolution. It ran an 8080 Intel 8080 chip, which was the kind of first semi x86.
Yeah, not quite. Really x86. It was kind of the first pre x86 chip. is an 8-bit Intel CPU, and then the 8086 came along, which was their 16-bit chip that kind of, you know, kicked off x86. But the thing I read is that they required that the 8086 be 8080 compatible.
Yeah, of course.
Meaning that elements of that 8-bit 8080 have trickled down like all the way to today.
You're saying that there's a little piece of that computer buried deep in the heart of my CPU? Yes,
there's a little 8080. There's a little Altair 8080. There's too many 88, man. I can't keep these all straight. Altair 8800. There's a little bit of that in all of us.
But so at this point, there's already two things that are really interesting to me about this. One, okay, so this is the computer that has just a bunch of red LEDs and switches on the front.
Yeah, like you should go, if you don't know what this thing looks like, you should go Google a picture, because it's not even like, as far as primitive computers go, it's not even an IBM PC or Apple II style computer. It looks like a piece of equipment from Apollo Mission Control.
And watching videos about this and learning a little bit about this, I understand why people were excited, because I guess prior to this point, if you wanted to buy a computer for home use or like small office use, like the smallest thing you could get was like the size of a refrigerator. Right. It had like big paper tape machines and a bunch of blinky lights, and it was huge and probably required like a lot of power.
Right. Yeah. But the front of this thing is like it is the most 70s design aesthetic looking thing I have ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
It is nothing but red LEDs and big rugged metal toggle switches that you work like. I think you're like literally checking memory addresses by flipping switches on the front of this thing, right? Uh-huh. That's basically how you operate it. I mean, it also monitor optional or maybe not even available at release. Like it was a teletype machine, so you were spitting the output onto like paper tape and using a keyboard that way.
Well, onto printouts, but it did have paper tape. It had a 9600 baud paper tape reader that you could hook up to it.
Sorry, yeah, like a dot matrix paper feed is what I meant.
Yeah, but a teletype's different than that. A teletype is a two-way thing. It just uses a big roll of paper as the output, is my understanding.
Instead of a screen.
But like if you type into it, it types onto the paper, but the machine also knows what you typed.
Right.
So like you could type in it, and this computer is also interesting because it's the first Microsoft product. Like BASIC for this computer was the first Microsoft product.
So skipping ahead like a handful of months from January. The founding of a company called Micro-Soft, with capital S, was the original name of Microsoft, founded by Bill Gates.
In Albuquerque?
So the Altair 8800 came out of Albuquerque. It was actually designed by military engineers.
That makes sense. People from Los Alamos.
Yeah, it was some Air Force engineers, after they got out of the service, founded this company and built the Altair. And then Microsoft was founded to offer Altair BASIC for that machine.
The other thing that's amazing to me about this computer that I didn't really appreciate is that at that point in time, the hoist of magazines was enough. Like the lift of a magazine was enough that they would commission somebody to design a computer that would then be sent mail order.
So that was the thing I didn't finish saying earlier, is not only was it revealed on the cover of that issue of Popular Electronics, it was also sold out of the back of that same issue. mail order hobbyist. I mean, this thing was extremely specialized equipment, right? Even if it was generally available, it was like you needed to really know your stuff to use this thing. But I just think it's funny that like product revealed in magazine and also sold in magazine at the same time.
By the way, how much did it cost, Brad?
I've got the price list in front of me. Let me pull that up here. So this table is broken down. I was not super familiar with these terms. The kit price of an Altair 8800 was $439.
That's it? I mean, it's 1975 money, so it's like, it's like $2,000 now, but $3,000 now. But.
With an assembled price of $621. So
do you know what the kit, do you not know what the kit means?
I assumed the assembled price meant they would just ship you the entire thing ready to use for that price. But I didn't know if kit price was like their manufacturing cost, or can you just buy the raw parts at that price from them and do it yourself?
So kit price is getting all the boards and case and stuff and the components without having the components soldered on the board.
Oh, wait, they didn't even do the soldering?
No.
Well, I guess everything was like all the ICs and stuff were fat enough at that point that like the pins were big enough you could just do that soldering, right?
Probably the only IC on the board would have been the 8088.
The chip.
The 8080. Yeah. The other stuff would have been like transistors and diodes and stuff like that, and they'd be all through hole, so it'd be easy soldering. There was a kind of thing that happened in the early 70s, maybe even late 60s. There were a bunch of companies that did, but the one that I was familiar with was Heathkit, and they, when solid state hi-fi stuff became popular, then they were selling kit kit hi-fi things, and you could buy it like with a case, or they would also just send you the plans for the case. And if you knew a cabinetry guy, you could make your own.
Oh, that's amazing. So
you had the people making like awesome burled maple hi-fis and stuff.
I miss that era of kind of sort of consumer products, but also kind of like DIY. Like he's like, oh, I know a cabinet maker who's going to make the housing for my stereo.
It's funny because like I had hoped that we would see that stuff come back on like Kickstarter and stuff like that. But like we would see somebody doing a Kickstarter for an old Heathkit hi-fi. Because like my parents had a Heathkit hi-fi that one of their friends put together for them who's into electronics.
I want to say there is at least some movement toward that kind of DIY, like home built, at least speaker design, if nothing else.
Well, I know. I know that a bunch of people, like I saw a redo of like the old 70s and 70s circuit design, like the circuit design kits where the PCB had the printout of the of all the instructions to put it together and how it worked and the theory bind and stuff like that. Like that stuff has been in and out for a while. But I haven't seen anything as involved as like the Heathkit stuff. And the fact that you could buy this as a kit is not at all surprising to me, and explains why especially UK magazines would still do really, really bonkers tie-ins. Like there's a model making magazine in the UK where if you subscribe for 2 years, you basically get a $3,000 ship in a bottle that you have to assemble yourself.
That's an expensive ship in a bottle.
There was one that did a studio scale Millennium Falcon a few years ago.
What?
That was like a 4-year project. And each month you would get a little bag of pieces, and you do that bag of pieces and you put it onto the final thing, and then you move on and on and on.
What is studio scale?
Studio scale would be about 4 feet across.
Oh, it kind of fit in a room.
So it's not as big as like the full scale shooting models that they did for like the Star Destroyers and stuff like that. That were like 15 feet long, but it's the next, it's physically the same size as that. So it'd be like four feet across. With really incredible attention to detail, so and like lighting kits and all that stuff.
You probably could shoot it as a miniature if you had to.
You absolutely could shoot it as a miniature. Yeah.
It's fun. I don't know if I know you've got plenty of experience with like talking to Phil Tippett and people like that, but if you ever dig into some of those fan communities, like I spent way too much time reading about Star Trek The Next Generation at one point and like the making of it. And like they had like a 6-foot model that they never used because they didn't want to drag it out of storage. And then there's a 4-foot model that they always used because it was easier to shoot around. And like all the hardcore fans hate the 4-foot model because it looks terrible next to the big, you know, nice one. But
the bigger one's like the title sequence one. Yeah, right?
Like they did the title sequence and like three other shots that they reused throughout the series with the 6-footer. And then it never got used again. And people were very bitter about it.
It's funny going back and watching that stuff now, because I was rewatching TNG when the good redos came up on Netflix or CBS All Access or whatever, and the number of reused interstitial shots is enormous.
It's wild. Start seeing some side by sides, like it's crazy. I mean, you know, they were working on a super tight schedule and like kind of a tight budget as well, right? Like you kind of had to do stuff like that. It's understandable, but it's pretty eye opening when you really side by side it.
The planet shots are the same, and then they just matted in a different planet.
Yep. Yep. There are shots in Next Generation that are straight up pulled from like the original series movies. Like I think it's it's like I want to say it's Star Trek 3. There's a shot of like a star base that they just straight up took that element and used it in Next Generation and had the Enterprise dock with it. I mean, like, you know, like it's conceivable that same star base would be around 80 years later. Right.
Well, and all of the like a lot of the ships were the same, too. Like anyway. A different topic for another day.
This is a whole other episode. I think, did you know that I want to say I don't want to get this backwards. It's the Romulan ships started as Klingon designs or vice versa. I forget which it is.
The Romulans bought Klingon ships was the in fiction excuse.
Right. But I think behind the scenes, they had designed it for one of those factions and then ended up using it for the other, but they didn't bother to change the design. Like I could read about that stuff all day. But anyway,
I want to talk about, I think we should do a full episode about the Altair.
Yeah, that's very intimidating. That's very intimidating to me, but I will follow you on that journey.
Yeah. I think it's a weird piece of electronics and I'm very curious about it now.
We should link that YouTube video I sent you in the show notes. There's a guy I just found randomly on YouTube, a guy who really knows his way around an Altair 8800.
Yeah.
Watching him work that thing is frightening almost.
Well, the cool thing I was going to say is I found a couple of cool things about this. One is that there's a Mr. Core that seems to be pretty functional. The other is that you can take an Arduino Mega or a Dewey and basically build a fully functional emulator, because that Arduino, that ATmega on the Arduino is going to emulate at about the same speed, and you can wire up all the switches and lights and stuff, and it actually just works.
Oh, that's wild.
And that's an available project. So if you want to make a fake Altair 8800, you can.
I bet that is an incredibly educational process.
I bet it would be. That seems like the kind of thing that if I'm still interested in this in a few years when my daughter is in middle school, I'm going to offer as a middle school class for the kids to sign up for.
That would be so rad. Can I sign up for that class? I promise I won't say anything. I'll just sit quietly in the back.
Yeah, that's fine. You can assist. You have skills.
That's true. I'll learn. There's one more thing I want to say about the Altair before we move on.
Yeah.
It spawned what became the first industry standard kind of interconnect system bus. That was used in other computers down the line, the S100 modular system bus. But the reason I think that's amusing is that came about because their production schedule was so tight that all the parts they needed to build the computer were not available on the schedule they wanted. So they made the motherboard just a simple interconnect, just a bunch of basically expansion slots on a circuit board, and build expansion cards out of all the parts as they got them in and just plug all those cards in because they didn't have the stuff they needed to put it all on the same board. So they just made a bunch of expansion cards instead.
Wow. So they accidentally made the first expandable
It really makes me wonder if is that just happenstance that brought about the expansion card model way earlier than it otherwise probably would have happened.
God, if that hadn't happened, it's entirely if that hadn't happened, then later on when the Apple II and the first Intel IBM PCs and stuff came out, they might not have included expansion slots. Right. And you might have just been stuck with what was soldered onto the board.
Totally. It's wow. I love little historical elements like that. That's just things just went that way because they were forced to do it that way. And then but look how that turned out.
That's fascinating.
Also, last thing I'll say about that, I've got to find this page. It is the S-100 bus. There's a Wikipedia page for it. I guess a bunch of other little companies sprung up around the Altair and its success.
Like building accessories and stuff for it.
You can go to that page if you want and see this picture. One of the companies that sprung up is called Chromemco, or was. I mean, they're long gone.
Pretty good name.
There's a picture here of the founders of Chromemco kneeling in the grass in their shitty 70s business suits and aviator sunglasses, holding that expansion board.
Okay.
That is just the most 70s-ass computer business photo I have ever seen in my entire life. It will be the episode art of the show today.
Excellent.
But this guy's shit eating grin with his aviators and his gold watch and his business suit and this computer board and his 70s haircut. You really have to see it.
It's amazing. It's amazing to me that this was such a cottage. Have you watched Halt and Catch Fire?
No, I really should.
So maybe that's a thing we can do as a show thing, because I just started watching it. And I was like, I need to watch this with Brad because we need to talk about some of these episodes.
Is it fictionalized or is it about real events? Is it based on?
I do not know, but it is about basically the fiction of this show is that it's the company that builds the first IBM PC clone.
Okay.
And how they reverse engineered the BIOS so that they could rerun IBM software without copyright infringement, basically.
I'll have to look at it. Yeah, I've been familiar with that show. I wasn't sure if it was based on real events or if they kind of did a dramatic treatment of it.
My guess is it's a dramatic treatment of something that happened in reality, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I should absolutely I think I've talked about it before. Pirates of Silicon Valley is my favorite TV movie ever.
Yeah, it has very much those vibes, but it is not. But I mean, Pirates was fictionalized too. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Pirates depicted some other stuff we will talk about from 1975 in this episode.
Interesting. Space Mountain opened in January. Mm. I thought that was cool. Space Mountain was the first roller coaster I ever rode.
Really? The first one?
First scary metal one. I rode little kid roller coasters and stuff before.
Was that the Disneyland Space Mountain or the Disney World Space Mountain?
I've never been to Disneyland, so
I haven't
the Disney
either.
World Space Mountain.
I haven't either. That was so weird moving to California because everybody here has been to Disneyland and I have not.
Yeah, we were planning on taking my daughter to Disneyland last year, and then you didn't know how that worked out.
Yes. If you were on the East Coast, you ended up going to Florida.
It seems like the feeling I get, having never been to Disneyland, but going on Kinect's Disneyland Adventures multiple times, is that the Disneyland version is a little bit charming, but the Disney World vision is bigger and better in every important way.
Yes, but also way swampier.
Yeah, way, way muggier. It was interesting because that was one of the first indoor steel coasters. It was the first steel coaster dark ride.
Oh.
Or from my cursory research, that's what I found.
I like Spaceship Earth. That's more my speed.
I don't think Spaceship Earth is Spaceship Earth anymore, Brad.
Is it not?
No, I think they replaced it with something else.
That's so sad.
It was inside the golf ball at Epcot.
That probably says a lot about me. I mean, I have nothing against roller coasters, but riding that thing and seeing all the like early humans discovering fire stuff on like this nice slow educational ride was much more my thing.
I rode that 3 or 4 times when we went to Epcot. The other thing that's gone that I really loved was Horizons at Epcot, which was one of the like the dark rides where you go through and it shows you like the history of technology or something presented by Shell or somebody.
Yes, I totally did that. Yes, that's right. Yes, presented by a large oil company.
So Horizons, when they took out the FedEx branding from Space Mountain a few years ago, apparently they put in nods to Horizons because that was going away and was becoming like a Cars ride or something around the same time.
That's sad.
Yeah. Progress, Brad.
Yeah.
The inevitable march of progress.
Sure. Yes, that's exactly what that is. Progress. Next.
The Homebrew Computer Club.
Yeah.
This is like, I remember this, of course.
I mean, that was a wee babe. I didn't realize we were getting to that right now, but that is the thing in Pirates of Silicon Valley I was talking about. There is a scene of that happening.
This is the now famous like Silicon Valley nerds before Silicon Valley was Silicon Valley.
Yes.
This is where Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak brought the first Apple computer. Yes. The
Apple One mounted in that cobbled together wooden case. Like there's photos of that thing out there. I'm sure it's in a museum somewhere.
Yeah. This is where Hewlett and Packard came together. And
really,
I believe that was where they were part of this, but I could be wrong. Maybe I am wrong. I'm questioning myself now.
Well, you know, I mean, it started in was it Menlo Park? Somewhere in the South Bay.
It's Cupertino or something, I thought, right?
It started in a Silicon Valley garage, like literally in a garage. And it only ran for a couple of years. But yeah, like, I guess the Apple is really the big claim to fame for that, right?
Like it sounded like a big swap meet, kind of.
That's what it was. It was a bunch of engineers and nerds coming together to swap things. I mean, that's the real historical artifact out of that thing is that Wozniak wanted to distribute the plans for the Apple One to all the members of that computer club so they could just build it themselves, right?
What a different world it would have been.
And then fate, and by fate, I mean Steve Jobs, intervened and said, hey, what if we sold that to people for large amounts of money instead of you just giving it away? And thus was born the personal computer industry.
So this happened March 5th, 1975. This happened in Gordon French's garage.
Yeah.
In Menlo Park. You're right.
Yes. And I think the funny thing is, I think Gordon French actually bailed after like 3 meetings and like moved across the country for a job or something. So he didn't even see all the good stuff, but
that seems right. The subsequent meetings were at the Slack, the Stanford Linear Accelerator, which is where it's that long building that you drive over when you go down 280 towards San Jose. This is weird to me that I live where this happened now. You know what I mean? This is a thing you heard about when you were kids.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, at least.
Well, now it's all taken on the air of history, right? Like when we were young, it was still happening. It was business. It was like, you know, current events. But now it's like, well, you know, most of the people that participated in this are elderly or passing on at this point.
Yeah.
And it's becoming a thing that happened and was important rather than is happening.
So the other people that were part of the club, Harry Garland and Roger Mellon, who were from Cremenco.
Yes,
they were pictured on the cover of this week's episode, I believe. Yes,
those guys were part of it before they hit the big time.
Adam Osborne, the Osborne computer guy, was one of these folks.
Yes, whole bunch of companies, computer companies spawned out of that thing.
Jerry Lawson, who created the first cartridge-based video game system, the Fairchild Channel F.
Oh.
Which I believe we can also emulate on the Mister these days. It was this was a thing. They had a newsletter. It looks like it was printed on a dot matrix printer, if I had to guess.
I should hope so.
It looks very cool.
Yes.
Okay. What else we got? What's next?
Let's see. So that happened in March, the whole Microsoft being founded and offering Altair a basic program happened around that time as well.
Watch the video that's linked in the show notes so you can see how you loaded the basic program and how you checked that it loaded properly, because it's incredible.
And that guy doing it was with that video was with an add-in board that makes that easier, apparently. Like it sounds
he had an EEPROM.
Sounds like without that bootloader prom that he's got in there, that was way more arduous. one factoid that did not happen in 1975, but that I really wanted to mention while I was reading up on this stuff. Did you know that before Microsoft, Paul Allen and Bill Gates had founded another company called Trafo Data? You look stunned.
Is the O capitalized, Brad?
Yes, yes, it is. It is Traf-O, capital O, dash data. It was a company that was trying to build a computer to analyze traffic data.
I'm going to say that when you're starting a new company, people tell you not to worry too much about the name, just to get out there and start building something. Because if you do it right, then nobody will care what the name is. And then they point to things like Salesforce and Oracle and stuff like that. And I think that there may be bad names out there. Traffic data is a bad name.
I think there are names bad enough to sink your venture.
Holy crap.
Trafo Data is one of them. At the same time,
here at Trafo Data Industries.
I mean, Microsoft is just short for microcomputer software.
Yeah. That was a 70s. Yeah. Smashing those words up. Saul Bass style.
I had to throw that out there. I thought that was very funny. Also,
that's a nightmare.
The other thing I read as I was researching early Microsoft was, did you know that when Paul Allen was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma and had to step back from the company? This is apocryphal. This is according to Paul Allen, that Bill Gates wanted to dilute his ownership of the company because he wasn't working hard enough.
Yeah, I had heard that. I don't know if that's true or not.
That's what Paul Allen said in his book.
It was pretty cutthroat back then.
I was going to say, yes, this is a very different image of the Bill Gates than the one we know.
Look, is man not entitled to the sweat from his own brow?
It was pretty sweaty in Albuquerque, I'm sure.
Look, the early pirates of Silicon Valley heard about the young libertines, but they thought they were talking about libertarians. And anyway,
yeah.
What else happened in 75? This is fantastic. This is your life, but it's not about me. This is the best thing we've ever done.
You were around for some cool stuff, though. Let's see. I hate to do all the hardcore computing stuff right up front, but that's kind of the order we're going in here. I guess the last thing I'll say. Well, this ties into that other stuff. Let's just go ahead and hit this one as well. The MOS 6502 CPU released in 1975.
What is the 6502 famous for?
Which is like arguably one of the most influential CPUs in history.
Ooh.
How about I just rattle off some of the things that the 6502 was used for? Devices that were based on it. If you remember when we had Mike Micah on last year, he was talking about learning assembly as a kid. It was 6502 assembly is what he was talking about learning. Like that was the thing you learned in that era. So the Acorn Atom, the Acorn Electron, the Apple I, the Apple II, the Apple IIe, the Atari 2600, 5200, and 7800.
Wow.
The Atari 800 computer.
Wait, the Atari 2600 and the Apple II had the same processor in them?
I don't know if they were being used as the processor in both cases. It could have been some kind of co-processor, but probably. Okay. Most likely.
Yeah, I mean, that seems right.
Most likely. The Atari 800 computer, the Atari Lynx apparently had it. The
handheld?
Yes.
Wow.
The BBC Master, the BBC Micro, the Commodore PET, VIC-20, Commodore 64, and Commodore 128. The Famicom and Nintendo Entertainment System.
Really?
Yes. Wow. There's some other stuff.
I wonder if that was the first thing that they shipped a billion of.
Maybe?
I wonder what the first microprocessor they shipped a billion units of.
That's a good question.
It's probably either that or the 80886 probably would be my guess.
I read up on it. I've always heard about the 6502 and I didn't know why it was so significant. Apparently it was made by former Motorola engineers who were basically trying to build a cheaper version of the Motorola 6800. Mm-hmm. Which was a common CPU at that time.
Yeah.
But it was, let's see, this says that the 6502, when it came out, sold for less than 1/6 of the competing designs from companies like Motorola's 6800 or the Intel 8080. So you can see why it would be so influential if it was like roughly as good as those for 1/6 of the price. It says that the 6502 and the Zilog Z80, which I'm sure you've heard of, are kind of like the first like true cheap commodity processors that really kicked off that revolution.
And this is why we started seeing things like the TI-99/4A and all those kind of not clones, but just like there was a weird proliferation of completely incompatible processors and systems at that time period, which was weird.
I want to say, I think that when I got a TI-85 in high school,
oh yeah,
was the first time I heard of a Zilog Z80. Isn't that what those are based on?
I have no idea on this stuff. This was before I was paying attention to this.
I believe that's the case. I could be wrong. I'm sorry to just turn this into Brad Google's things.
Look, I didn't realize that computers were cool until like 1991, probably.
Yeah, it was kind of 94-ish is when I started thinking like, hey, there's more to do with these things than just play video games.
I guess I knew that I liked the TI-94A. I like typing programs in BASIC, but I never had the impetus to learn how to write code, really.
Yeah.
And like, it's just, it seemed like it lost usefulness pretty quickly. And then the NES came out and I enjoyed playing games on that, but I didn't even think about that as a computer. It was just a thing you jam cartridges into and then were entertained.
I had no idea that the NES had a 6502 in it until I read this list. I knew it was the Apple II.
You 2 years old?
Yes, basically.
Nice.
The Tamagotchi, remember that? That had a 6502 in it.
Like, so think about, like, this is the thing that's fascinating for me. In the course of my life, we've gone from the introduction of the first microcomputer, like personal computer type thing with the Altair, to, like, I have a phone that I carry around that probably is equivalent to all of the computing power in the world in like 1982 or something.
Probably, maybe faster, maybe more, actually.
Yeah, like I kind of want to do the math on that and see how many teraflops my 3080 has versus the world in what year. Like,
it's a lot to think about.
Did those lines cross?
That's a lot to think about.
The first videotape stuff came out that year.
Yeah. Sony released the Betamax home video recorder. I want to say in Japan only at first.
So here's the difference. You were born a few years after me.
Yeah, I was born in 79. So
I remember when my dad brought home the first VCR that we'd seen.
Okay.
Like I have a distinct memory of him coming home with a luggable VHS or VC. I might've been a Betamax. I don't even know. But it had like a case with shoulder straps and it was two pieces.
Yes. Yes.
There was the piece with the head unit where the tape went in. And then there was the piece that you connected to the TV and you connected those two together with a huge cable.
Yep.
And it was like each one was like together. They would have been wider than what we think of as like modern stereo width, which is like a one U rack with like a, you know, rack width. And he brought home, I feel like we watched Black Hole, the Disney movie from 1979.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't remember what the other thing might have been something that mom and dad watched that was not appropriate for kids. But the Black Hole scared the living shit out of me. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but like they turn people into robots. It's real scary. Yeah. Yeah. Especially for Touchstone or whatever, Buena Vista Productions, whatever it was back then.
Scary movies, educational theme park rides. It was a very different Disney back then.
Look, the thing I will say about Black Hole is Slim Pickens plays one of the robots.
Okay.
He's great. Slim Pickens always good in my book. And Ernest Borgnine plays a human. So like,
enough said.
Yeah. Love the Borgnine.
I get what you're picking it up. So yeah, our first VCR was the same way. Like I'm not old enough to remember not having it, but it was definitely one of those kind of two for one gigantic double box situations.
Yeah.
My dad bought a camcorder. All of my childhood home movies are shot on this camcorder he bought that went with that set.
Oh man, I can't wait for the video podcast of those.
And the fun part is you had to take the tape deck half of the VCR, stick a strap on it and sling it over your shoulder and hook the camera up to that. So like anytime he was shooting home movies around the house, he literally was like wearing half of the VCR hanging off his shoulder, hooked up to the camera he was shooting with.
And what was the battery life? Like 8 minutes? Oh, probably.
God, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wow.
He might have had to plug into a wall. I don't know. Maybe you had to be near a power source. I'm not sure.
Huh.
So like I'm not old enough for Beta. I don't know if I've ever actually seen a Betamax deck in person.
You have, because you hadn't seen it, I'm sure.
I will say outside of like a GameSpot, because at that time, like even in the late 90s, 2000s, most game footage was distributed on Beta tapes.
Yeah. I remember the first time I went to E3 and they handed out like CD-ROMs, I guess,
right,
recordable CDs. And that was like a huge moment.
Like Betacam was huge in like TV broadcast for a long time, but in home consumer tapes, it was VHS versus Betamax. And I always heard about that as like the prototypical format war. Like that was the original format war, right?
Yeah.
There's two competing formats going head to head. One is better than the other one, but like which one will reign supreme? Turned out it was the one that was cheaper and good enough.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it was the first time prior, like, I don't know who owns the IP for cassette tapes, actually.
Like, wait, audio cassette tapes?
Like audio cassette tapes. Yeah, somebody.
I don't know.
There has to be patents and licensing on that, right?
I guess, yeah. Well, would that have expired by now?
Well, yeah, it would have, but like maybe the record industry bought that stuff and just like they were just like, hey, here's an easy format for you to distribute music in that works in the car without scratching your records or whatever.
Right.
Like the phonograph probably doesn't have that, if I think about it.
Probably not.
It existed for too long.
I don't know. I record everything on wax cylinder. Thank you. It's got a warmer, more natural sound. I've always heard that like Beta was better, but VHS won, but I never knew why. So I kind of looked into it and there's all kinds of weird, basically sounds like Sony tripping over itself repeatedly. they own the IP and JVC owned VHS. Sony insisted on making all the Beta stuff themselves while JVC just licensed the tech out to whoever. And they all made competing VHS machines. So they all, you know, race to the bottom.
Yeah. Rising Beta. Tide lifts all ships is the other way to say that.
Sure. Yeah. However you want to look at it. Beta was technically higher resolution than VHS.
But only like 10 or 15 lines.
10 lines, you know, but technically better sound. It had less image jitter than VHS.
Actually, it turns out the image jitter is 30% better on my Betamax than your VHS.
Yes. Yes, it was basically that. Also, they limited Beta tapes to only an hour, where VHS tapes were two initially, meaning that you could tape an entire movie off of TV without having to switch tapes.
So the interesting thing about that is that was because Sony was afraid they were going to get sued by the movie people.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then they did get sued by the movie people.
Really?
Which led to the fair use doctrine.
No kidding.
And or right of first sale. One of the important copyright doctrines is that, hey, once you copying was not piracy.
Okay.
Because like up until that point, there was a feeling and the movie industry was trying to put this forward that if you copied the thing that I did, that my parents did by copying, recording Star Wars off of CBS when it was aired over the air, was piracy.
No kidding.
Think about that.
I bet they would have loved to get away with that.
Well, it went to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court was like, basically, no, dog, it was over the airwaves. They're just time shifting. That's totally fair.
Much
as
like,
long as they don't sell and distribute those tapes, it's fine.
Much like we had a very different Disney back then, we also had a very different Supreme Court and political apparatus.
I think that I feel
that those protections are just being eroded systematically, right?
Probably true. I feel like that is another. So on the list of things that we should talk about at some point, I think that is one that we should get a lawyer in to talk about because it is a very interesting topic. And the way that worked out was not the way you would expect based on the kind of party theses at the time.
Huh.
Anyway.
Yeah. So yes, Beta was the original example of a better format being destroyed by the thing that was cheaper and more accessible.
Yep. That makes sense.
Which has then played out again over and over and always ends the same way. Well, so, usually.
Yeah, I mean, Blu-ray won when HD-DVD was the more open one.
I don't want to speak out of turn. I would have to research to make sure. But my memory of that is that Sony pulled some behind the scenes maneuvering and like
they put it in the PlayStation.
Well, there was that. But they also I'd swear they paid some companies off in some way to boost Blu-ray somehow. I can't remember exactly how that went down, but it was not a pure market forces determining the winner situation. It was like there was some business behind the scenes.
I think my understanding is that they owned movie studios at that point. So there were some movies that were never going to be available on HD DVD.
It might have been some stuff like that as well. Yeah, like HD DVD was, I think, the better and cheaper format, but it did not win in that case.
The other thing on Beta versus VHS is that Sony didn't allow pornography on Beta tapes.
That's always the real bellwether,
which everybody always says that when you're talking about stuff there, like even when we started VR stuff 5 years ago, people were like, well, what's the porn situation like, which is fucking always creepy when people are like, investors are like, hey, what's going on with porn on this?
Mm-hmm. They know where the money is.
I feel like that was much less important than the 1 hour tapes and everything being way more expensive.
Well, at that time, I mean, like the whole industry was nascent, right? Like,
I mean, the porn industry or the video industry,
like the adult film industry. Like there wasn't that much of that to go around to put on tapes at that time. Right.
My understanding of what the adult industry was like in the early mid 70s is entirely based on fictionalized accounts like Boogie Nights.
Sure.
So I don't, I don't know. I feel like there was probably a lot of money going around, judging by the copious drug use is depicted in fiction.
Yes.
I don't know.
I just watched Boogie Nights again a couple weeks ago.
It's a fine film.
It still holds up quite well. And I think I determined I don't ever need to watch it again. It's too depressing.
It's funny. It's like the level of depressing it gets the older I get is marked.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the next thing on our list is the end of the space race.
Oh,
the Apollo Soyuz handshake in space, or as it's officially known, the Apollo Soyuz test project.
Oh,
which was basically in the mid-70s, we were done going to the moon almost. And they'd built a bunch of these Saturn V rockets and they'd built a bunch of these Apollo capsules. And they were like, what can we do with these? So they used a couple of the Saturn V rockets to fire Voyager probes out into the cosmos.
Wait, those were Saturn V?
Yeah, those are Saturn V.
I did not know that.
Because remember, originally the Apollo program was going to be longer. It was going to go longer.
Right. That's right. Was it just funding cuts that killed it, or was it like 13 and some of the disasters as well, or mostly funding? I'm sure
nobody watched anymore.
Okay.
Like we went to the moon like 5-6 times. People were like, we've done this. Is golf on?
we're on the moon again this week.
Yeah. What? They're driving a buggy. Yeah. I don't even know.
No.
So the going to the moon, and then also they had extra capsules. So they talked to the Russians. The Russians were focusing on space stations at this point because they'd lost the moon. They were launching the Salyut space stations, and they'd had, you know, the two things reading about this that I didn't appreciate. One is that the Russian space program was incredibly secretive, in a way that it's hard to appreciate here, because like instead of showing live video from the moon or from the people on the way to the moon, you would only hear about Russian space stuff. Like they only aired footage after they were back and it went well.
Of course. I mean, that was just total state media control, right?
Right. But like there were a couple of deaths. There were accidents involving deaths, stuff like that. There was an accident earlier in 75 with the Soyuz 18A, I think, where the second and third stages didn't separate properly. And they had to they just did a suborbital flight.
Huh.
Okay. Where they broke the capsule loose at the last minute and like ended up near China. And the cosmonauts had to camp for a night or two while they were waiting for the Russians to find them.
As long as they landed safely, I'm sure they were fine to hang out.
Look, they thought they were in China for a bit. And apparently China and Russia the USSR weren't super keen on each other at the time.
That was a rough time for them. Is Soyuz just a rocket design? It's not like an overarching program like Apollo, right? Does that just refer to the rocket?
Soyuz is the capsule. It's the capsule. So they have called a bunch of different things Soyuz over the years, but the gist is the same, which is that there's like a command module. The difference is that they had, so the little ball on top is the capsule where the people go.
Okay.
For the most part, but you also could go down into the, like their version of the, what's the thing, the tail of the command module in the Apollo called? The thing that blew up in Apollo 13.
Oh gosh, I can't remember.
It doesn't matter. It's the thing. There's like a little engine and all that. That part drops off on the Soyuz, and then the capsule re-enters, and then there's parachutes, and it's designed to land on land instead of water.
Oh,
so it has like retro rockets that fire at the last second slow it down.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious because I believe they still use the name Soyuz today, right?
Uh-huh. That's what takes the Russian cosmonauts to the space station still.
Right. Like that's what we have, like the US has contracted to kind of
until very recently
hitchhike on, right?
Yeah, exactly. At the time, Soyuz was only two people. So the handshake in space was three astronauts, two cosmonauts, and they designed a docking system that was universal and let either side, because of politics, I assume, either side could be the passive receiver for the docking port so that like Soyuz could dock with the Apollo or Apollo could dock with the Soyuz. And then they opened up the hatch between themselves. They shook hands in space. It was the first time Westerners, I think, were allowed at the launch facilities in Russia because it was military secrets up until that point.
Sure.
Because like rockets to go to space, ICBMs, same basic thing.
Rockets are really just the bomb delivery mechanisms. Just the fact that they were used for space exploration was a nice side benefit.
Yeah. The but so this basically founded this was the foundational work that became, you know, that preceded Americans in the shuttle program going to Mir,
right?
Which was Russia's longest running space station that was launched in the USSR when the USSR was still in charge, and then after the Soviets fell, was maintained by Russia for a few more years. Apollo astronauts, the Apollo crew was allowed to inspect the Soyuz capsule, which was the first thing. The other thing about this that was fascinating to me is, remember there were seven Mercury astronauts, the Mercury
yes.
seven?
Yes.
Only six of them. There were only six Mercury flights.
Okay.
So the seventh was supposed to be flown by Deke Slayton, who famously went on to command the astronaut corps for years and years and years, and like helped, was one of the establishing forces on the shuttle program. Deke Slayton had a heart arrhythmia, which is, I think, depicted in The Right Stuff even, and wasn't able to fly as part of Mercury. He was disqualified for flight then. He ended up being the docking pilot for this Apollo Soyuz test project, which was the only time he ever flew to space.
Okay. So he still got to go.
And like historians now generally regard this as the end of the space race. Up until this point, it was, you know, superpowers competing against each other. And then we entered an era of cooperation.
Yeah. It turns out you can get a lot more done.
I don't know about that, but
when you work, well, ideally. Also, I just have to say there is no way you don't end up probably, I assume, in a military role and then end up in the space program. There's no way you don't do that if you have a name like Deke Slayton.
Look, that's just a 50s name, man.
You are destined. You're destined to fly on a rocket someday if you have a name like Deke Slayton.
Deke is short for something that we don't. It's short for a name we don't use anymore, and I don't sure. know what it is now.
Yeah. Who can get there faster? Donald Kent Slayton is his full name.
Donald Kent. Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
There's
that 50s high and tight looking haircut. Yep.
It's the whole
thing.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
The other thing that's fun about this is that the Russians, both the Russians and the Americans, felt like everybody else's, the other side spacecraft were unreliable for the exact same reason as each other.
Sure.
So the Russians basically let the machines run everything, so there was no pilot error to be introduced. And the Americans were like, these are highly complicated capsules that have multiple redundancies that have to be controlled by a human. So the Russians were like, putting a human in charge of this thing is asinine. And the Americans were like, do you really trust a machine to fly a spaceship? Good God, man.
I feel like there's a cautionary tale about putting a machine in charge of all your rockets. What was it called?
That's probably fine. Probably nothing.
I was going to, one more thing I was going to ask if you happen to know. Do you know what became of Mir? Like, how do you decommission a space station? Like,
into the Indian Ocean.
Do they crash it? I was gonna ask if they like dismantled it and took it upon, like, tried to bring it down responsibly. But crashing it into the ocean also works.
They tried to aim it, as my understanding. But like, that is, it's hard to aim a falling spacecraft. I mean, we learned this with the Chinese thing that crashed a few days ago, right?
Yeah.
Because it. Like the top, like the edge of the atmosphere isn't like uniform, right? So
right.
Drag and friction and all that stuff can be affected by the orientation of the spacecraft, all the different stuff. So like the where this is going to crash was a period of three orbits, you know, around the Earth, somewhere on three different circles around the Earth, and over a period of like 18 hours or something like that. So Mir was the first modular space station, too, is the other thing. So they brought it up in multiple pieces and then assembled it in orbit.
Right.
Which is obviously what we did with the ISS, because it's way too big to have launched at this point.
Yes.
And it, I'm going to say, final days in deorbit. Yeah, broke up over the South Pacific.
Okay.
There's a picture on Wikipedia.
I assume they try to collect all that debris and not just let it sink, but I don't know.
No, I bet it just sunk into the ocean. Because how could they have boats in the place to know where it lands?
I guess. Okay. Fair point.
Yep. I'm surprised we haven't had a movie yet about the guy who was the people that were on Mir over the, you know, the fall of the Soviet Empire, Soviet Union. Because they were, for a long time, they were the longest duration, the longest single contiguous duration that somebody had been in space. Because like the Russians couldn't launch somebody new to get up to him, get up there.
Right.
and they didn't want to leave it untended because it would have crashed.
God, can you, like, I don't know a ton. I mean, I know a little bit about the fall of the Soviet Union, but the sheer administrative chaos that ensued that I'm aware of, like, I can't even imagine how stranded they felt up there.
Yeah, I feel like the launch facilities and stuff were in different countries after the fall of the Soviet Union, right? Like, yeah. Anyway. Wheel of Fortune premiered on January 6th of 1975.
Do you know if did they use, I'm sure they did not use screens for the letters, right off the bat.
Are you kidding?
Sure. I assume they had some kind of mechanical.
She used to spin the things.
Right. That's right.
What Vanna White's job was.
That's right. She physically spun a thing. Right?
She walked up in front. There was like a triangular shaped thing and she spun it.
That's
that was
right.
Her job.
Oh my God. I might've been young enough to see that at some point. Actually,
that was on when we were kids. Like when I was in high
school,
right, even, that was
okay.
The way it worked.
That's right.
Eventually they switched to the thing that was like the color, like the sign letters where she hit the button underneath,
right,
and the
she
light
just
turned on.
She walked up and hit a button like that. You really need a human being to do that at that point.
Yeah. That's it. That's all I got. Okay. Australia switched to full-time color TV on March 1st of 1975. So good job, Australia.
Yeah, but all the colors are backwards down there.
Upside down.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Jaws came out in June, which was the first summer blockbuster.
Yeah, I started to talk to. Should we get into this?
Jaws, dude. I don't have anything to say.
I was all excited when we were planning this episode to drop the "I've never seen Jaws" on you, and then you did it first. I was like, wait a minute, that's my thing.
We spoiled the planning. Look, I have a lot of gaps. I've never seen Rocky. I've never seen Jaws. I don't think I've seen the first Rambo.
I have not. I have also not seen any of those movies. What is wrong with us? Were we too busy fiddling with computers?
I don't really like Sylvester Stallone that much. And I've tried to watch Jaws multiple times, but I keep falling asleep. So
I am extremely on the Schwarzenegger side of that divide, if such a divide exists.
Wow, you think that's a spectrum? Like on one end is Arnold Schwarzenegger and one side is Sly Stallone?
We should ask Dan Reichert. I mean, I think they can be enjoyed together.
I like the Expendables okay. Mm. They're not good, but they're fun.
Wait, was Arnold in those?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
100%.
I thought he was too big for that.
No, he came in on the second one, I think. Maybe he was a bad guy on the first one, I think. Okay. I can't remember.
At some point, he got old enough that they could get him.
Yeah. The first one, I think he might have still been governor.
Okay, sure.
So he was busy, it turns out.
I would like to read up more on exactly in what ways Jaws invented the blockbuster. I mean, obviously, like there were some special effects. They were not like radically innovative.
Well, so the interesting thing to me about Jaws, I for somebody who's never actually seen the entire movie, we talked about it a lot at Tested with Adam. The thing about Jaws that's interesting is the shark scenes were effective because the shark was janky and didn't work. So they were forced to shoot around the shark being bad, which meant that they didn't really show the shark all that much. And that, like that, A, it invented the blockbuster because people came to see it like 18 times because they loved it, right? It was very exciting. B, the big effects robot being like the smallest part of the movie actually ended up making the movie much better. Like if they'd shown a bunch of the shark and it was the shitty shark robot, everybody would be like, oh, this is really stupid. Nobody likes it. But, you know, it's a less is more situation, I think, there. At some point, I should watch Jaws. I feel bad now.
We should probably watch Jaws.
Admitting that I've never watched Jaws. And then the last thing, and I thought this was a Saturn V too, but it was not, is Viking 1 launched in August. Viking, if you don't know, was the first successful landing on another on Mars by us. I think maybe the Russians had landed by then. They launched a Titan Centaur rocket.
Not to criticize 70s era NASA's naming schemes too much, but maybe starting multiple famous projects with V at that time was not the best idea.
Yeah, it's probably
because when you said Viking, I just thought Voyager and like could not distinguish. When was Voyager was also around the
Voyager same. Was like 76 or 78 was when they launched those
right around the same time, right?
The Voyager launched because at the times that did because they had planetary alignments to let them do Holtzmann transfers to get and gravity slingshots.
Right.
So they stole a little bit of momentum from Jupiter and Saturn to accelerate into the outer solar system. And because we had those enormous rockets, we were able to do able to add more delta V than we would have been able to otherwise.
Right.
So the Viking was two parts, a lander and an orbiter. I didn't realize that the Vikings lasted. So they didn't move. They just landed and they scooped directly underneath them.
Okay.
They had like a long arm that could scoop, and it had like a very limited number of tools on the lander. It was phenomenally expensive for the time. And that's kind of it. Like, they were looking for life, signs of life. They wanted to show that they could land. They had a bunch of, because they couldn't move, they used a bunch of small rockets around that were just aimed out to not disturb the ground underneath the lander as much as they could.
Interesting.
But it's interesting because, like, I don't know how they, like, you think about how complicated the landings are now for something like Perseverance. It's fascinating how primitive this is in retrospect. Like, the cameras on this thing were so slow at taking photos that, like, the dust from the landing was still visible on one half of the picture. because of the way the scanning worked on the camera.
So this was the first successful landing of anything by anyone on another planet?
I think it was the first successful landing of anyone on Mars, is okay. My understanding.
Okay. Because I think they were sending stuff to Venus in the 70s as well, weren't they?
Yeah, the Russians sent a lot of stuff to Venus. And those
lasted like 5 minutes.
They lasted not very long because Venus, it turns out, is incredibly hostile to everything.
It is a hellscape.
Yeah. But the Mars surface mission went for 6.25 years. So 2,245 sols.
That's respectable.
Which was only broken by Opportunity in 2010.
Wow. That's very respectable.
Yeah. Not bad. I remember these pictures from Viking are still striking to me. And it was originally, here's the fun thing, the politics that I don't think NASA involves itself in now. It was originally supposed to land on July 4th, 1976, rather, yeah. Which would have been the 200th anniversary of the founding of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. They had to delay until July 20th, which was the 7th anniversary of the Apollo landing. Because it was too, the original landing site was bad.
I know.
They looked at the orbits.
As long as you can pull some anniversary out, you're fine.
Yeah. They just had to get, yeah, I just imagine Gerald Ford is standing in there. He's like, God damn it, get us a date. We just need a date. Damn it. I don't know why I'm doing voices all of a sudden this episode.
That's how everybody talked in the 70s.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody was named Deke and they talked like that.
I wish we had good, like, I don't even have a good nickname opportunity with my two first name. Anyway, first episode of SNL, October 11th, maybe the last time SNL was reliably good. Also, obvious jokes.
Some
sorry.
Parts of the 80s and 90s were okay.
Yeah. Benoit Mandelbrot.
Mandelbrot. We had a discussion about this.
Yeah.
It seems everyone says Mandelbrot.
Yeah.
And I mean everyone, but I did look up a video of the man himself saying his own name, and he said Mandelbrot.
Mandelbrot.
So
Benoit Mandelbrot.
So then you have to do the exercise. You say it the way that the person themselves says it, even though everyone will say you're wrong.
I personally believe that you say that the word the way that the originator intended.
Yes. Yes.
That's why I say GIF.
That's we're not.
What's he a coined fractal? The term fractal.
Yes.
Which turned out to be important for math and computers, and also screensavers for stoners in the 90s.
I mean, you say he coined the term was like the mathematical construct kind of understood and in use before that, and he just named it, or did he also kind of develop the entire system?
These are all fantastic questions, Brad.
For a mathematician?
Yeah. Look, you can't invent math. You discover.
Oh, I know that. I'm just saying, was that model at least in use without a name prior to that, or
these,
did he?
These are all very good questions, Brad.
Did he do the whole soup to nuts fractal thing himself?
These are all very good questions, Brad.
Can you, I know. So here's what I know about fractals. Like I've obviously seen the famous zoom of the Mandelbrot set.
Uh-huh.
The infinite zoom.
Yep.
And I know that fractals occur like endlessly in nature.
Yep.
That's about all I've got.
That's what I got.
Okay.
They're important for cryptography. Maybe. I don't know.
Interesting. We should talk to a mathematician sometime.
I think that's a great idea.
I think we know a few.
But look, we can find mathematicians. Mathematicians for days.
That's right.
That's it for us this month.
Okay.
I guess.
Or this week.
This week, yeah. Thanks. Thanks for this walk down memory lane. I don't remember very much of this stuff.
Oh, 1975. What a heady year. What could have been?
I mean, look, If it weren't for that S100 slot, we could all have MacBooks now that you can completely enable to expand in any way at all.
Can you just imagine?
Other than using a series of proprietary dongles.
If the United States government had onerous requirements for the analysis of traffic data.
God.
If Trafo Data had just gotten that lucrative government contract, how different could things be now?
What if instead of Windows, we had roads?
Oh, man.
Yeah, I got my browser in a road over here.
That's definitely the end of the episode. Thank you for listening.
As always, this is the part of the show where we thank our patrons. Very special thank to our executive producer, to your patrons, the Bunny Fiend, Jacob Chappell, Twinkle Twinkie, and James Kamek. Thank you all so much. We appreciate you. And I'll also, of course, thank you to all of our patrons. We've had a lot of new people come in the last week, and it's been a little chaotic in there. So I think we have to add some more channels, Brad, is the TLDR.
I almost just did it after you suggested it, but I figured we should at least discuss it first. And that is create a shitposting channel.
I think I'm going to turn off the ability to put attachments in the main general channel.
That might be the thing to do.
Because I have to imagine it's a little intimidating for new people.
Yeah.
But the thing to do is to dig in to if you're scared by general, just go into a channel that looks interesting. Like old PC stuff will be popular this week because of the episode, I would bet. But there's a bunch of other topics of interest. And if there's something that we don't have in there that like you feel like you see people talking about in general that would deserve its own channel, even if it's like a relatively low traffic one, we can definitely add it. So please let us know if you're in there.
Those become great resources for those topics.
Yeah.
Over time.
We have the number of times we've pulled ideas for an episode out of a conversation that started in one of the Discord channels we've done a bunch that way. So it's a two-way street, and I just like hanging out there, even if I'm not able to post a whole lot. So thanks to all of our patrons. If you aren't a patron, you can find out how to sign up at patreon.com/techpod.
That's
patreon.com/techpod. We haven't increased the prices yet. That's going to happen soon. But if you want to get access to the Patreon, to the Discord, you can right now for $2 a month.
Or retooled the tiers, I guess we should say. We're not just going to jack up the prices on the existing tiers. We're going to like rethink the offering there, like try to give you more for the money.
More good stuff.
And add some new bonuses.
The thing is, once you sign up, you're locked into that tier for as long as you want to stay on that tier.
Yeah.
Like we can't, if you're at the $2 tier, we can't start charging you $5. You have to sign up to change the $5 tier. Anyway, that's it for us, I guess, this month.
Thanks. Happy birthday.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you all next week.